Fatal Forces, a horrible science book by Nick Arndt, illustrated by Tony DeSalle. It's crunch time! Read by Vienna Vance. Introduction. Science has one fatal flaw. It can be seriously boring. Ask a simple question and you're forced to listen to a really boring, complicated answer. Why does my ball fall? The force of gravitational attraction between your spherical object and the Earth is determined by their relative masses. Your what? And some answers have masses in mysterious mathematics. But why does it fall so fast? Simple. 9.806 meters per second. G equals GM2R2. Totally bamboozled. And don't try arguing with the scientist either. So why doesn't it go up? Or it'll get a force field apply. You can't break the laws of physics, my girl. See what I mean? It's enough to make you die of boredom. Now that wouldn't be fatal. So what are these laws? And what happens if you break them? Do you get expelled? Or perhaps there's a really horrible punishment in store for you. Maybe you'll be forced to endure extra science lessons with megatons of homework. And who forces you to obey these horrible laws anyway? Teachers? No. Well, what's forcing me to fall then? Forces force you, because forces force things to move. And a force can be anything from you flicking a pea to the awesome gravity of a giant star. So the effects of forces could be an intergalactic explosion or the pea ending up in your teacher's ear hole. This might cause an explosion too. But forces can have fascinating fatal effects, like crushing people, or making them sick, or pulling their heads off. Getting forces wrong at school isn't usually quite as fatal, just a bit of enforced detention from your teacher. That must be one of those horrible forces you were telling us about, sir. Crunch. Arrgh! So here's the real-life story of forces. It's a story involving fatal fortunes and horrible happenings, and it's all true. And who knows? After your words, you might feel that forces have a fatal attraction for you, too. You might even force your teacher to take your science homework seriously. If you can just force yourself to read the next page now. And I mean now! Nasty Newton. The prisoner was sick. In the madness of his fever, he imagined the courtroom candles were fiery ghosts. Again and again, he heard the sentence of the judges. Death! Then he fainted. He woke in darkness. Dragging himself upright, he tried to explore the pitch-black cell. His feet slithered on the slimy floor. Then he stumbled, his hands grabbing at empty air. He'd collapsed on the edge of a bottomless pit. One more step and he'd have dropped like a stone. Exhausted, the prisoner fell asleep. But when he awoke, he found himself strapped to a low bench. Helpless, he peered upwards and gasped in horror. A giant statue towered over him. The grotesque figure had a huge pendulum swinging from its hands. The pendulum swung to and fro with an evil hiss. It ended in a razor-sharp blade, and each slow sweep brought his blade a little lower, a little closer. Hiss, hiss, hiss. Scores of huge rats stared hungrily from the shadows, waiting to feast on the prisoner's butchered corpse. The deadly hissing blade skimmed his bare chest. Don't panic, it's only a story. The Pit and the Pendulum was written in 1849 by the American author Edgar Allan Poe. But for scientists, Poe's story has a fatal fascination. The nasty forms of death. The Pit and the Pendulum involve forces. Falling into the well under the influence of gravity, the pendulum swing controlled by gravity and centripetal force. That's the force on the pendulum shaft that stops the swinging weight pulling away from the rest of the machine. These forces are fatal for the prisoner. Horrible health warning. Forces aren't human. You can't reason with them or persuade them. They are physical forces of nature with the power to kill. Fatal forces. Once you fall foul of fatal forces, you're finished. Postscript. Oh, by the way, I'll be pleased to know the prisoner escapes. How? By getting the rats to gnaw through his straps, of course. Bet you didn't think of that. Amazingly enough, these forces had already been explained by a forceful scientific megastar, the amazing Sir Isaac Newton. Hall of Fame, Sir Isaac Newton, 1642-1727. Nationality, British. Isaac Newton was born on Christmas Day. The doctor thought baby Isaac wouldn't live because he was so weak and small. Relax, Boxing Day will be nice and quiet. Ah! But Isaac survived. He soon became interested in science, but his teachers didn't think he was especially brainy. In fact, Isaac was too busy performing experiments at home to work hard at school. Don't try this excuse. When young Isaac was 16, his mom asked him to run the family farm. But he proved to be a useless farmer. He spent all his time experimenting and allowed the sheep to guzzle their way through a cornfield. He was the best farmer we ever had. So Isaac went to Cambridge University instead. At university, he read every maths book he could find, including the ones without pictures. He wore scruffy clothes and was so absent-minded he often got lost on his way to supper. As far as Isaac was concerned, supper was for wimps. Who needed supper when you could do lovely science calculations instead? In 1665, a deadly plague struck London. Soon, 7,000 people were dying every week, and the authorities closed Cambridge University to stop the plague spreading. So Isaac went home. But instead of taking a holiday, he did extra homework. Very strange. But what homework? He invented calculus, a mathematical system still used today to plan rocket trips, and they also discovered that light contains colors. These vital discoveries were to influence maths and physics for 300 years. Then Isaac made a really incredible breakthrough. It may have happened like this. The Apple and the Moon. Woolsthorpe, England, 1666. It was getting dark, but the skinny young man ran his fingers through his shoulder-length hair and carried on reading. Isaac Newton was sitting in the orchard trying to figure out how the moon went round the earth. Suddenly, a call rang out from the old farmhouse. Isaac, your supper's ready.
Yes, Mother.
Thought Isaac. She always called me half an hour before supper. It's a trick to get me in on time. So he did nothing. If he had left the orchard when his mother called him, the entire history of science would have been different. But just then, something grabbed his attention. It had been waiting for this moment, waiting for months, silently. At first, it was no larger than a tiny green bulge, but now it was bright red and the size of a man's fist, a living bubble of water and sugars with sweet, juicy flesh and bitter seeds, all wrapped in a waxy skin, an apple, the most famous apple in science. Isaac, your supper's on the table, and it's your favorite. Coming, Mother. Isaac shivered as a cool breeze rustled the trees. Then he sighed and reluctantly closed his book. There was a silent snap. A slender stalk holding the apple to the tree gave way. Wrenched by an unseen force, the apple hurtled downward. It tumbled through the rustling leaves and bounced gently on Isaac's brainy bumps. What would you have done? Perhaps you'd have eaten your supper and forgotten the apple. But Isaac wasn't like that. He rubbed his head and looked at the moon. It shone like a bright silver coin in the evening sky. So why doesn't the moon fall, too? He asked himself as he absentmindedly munched the famous apple. For some strange reason, Isaac remembered his school and the dreaded bucket game. He hated the other kids for making him play. He remembered having to whirl a bucket of water around his head on a rope. It was hard work, and Isaac was a thin little boy. But amazingly, all the water had stayed in the bucket, as if trapped by an unseen force. Yikes! Maybe that's what keeps the moon in place, he murmured. Then his mother shouted again, Isaac, your supper's on the table, and it's stone cold. I said, I'm coming, Mother. As Isaac threw the apple away, he wondered what would happen if it reached the moon. The most famous apple core in science disappeared. There was a muffled meow as it splatted on the cat. Isaac had forgotten his supper. He was calculating how strong gravity would need to be to stop the apple sailing into space. Then he thought about how fast the moon has to move to prevent it crashing down to Earth. Later, a very annoyed Mrs. Newton stood at the doorway, shielding her candle from the cold night air. Isaac, Shield, I've fed your supper to the cat. I'm going to feed your breakfast to the pigs. There was no answer from the orchard, but Isaac was still out there, and still thinking hard. Test your teacher. How much does your teacher really know about this famous scientist? 1. As a child, what was Isaac Newton's favorite toy? A. A chemistry set. B. A toy windmill powered by a mouse and a wheel. C. He hated toys. He preferred tricky math sums. Answer. 1. A toy windmill powered by a mouse and a wheel. He designed it himself. 2. What did he buy on his first day at university? A. A desk, ink, and notebook for extra homework. B. New clothes and a ticket to the local fun fair. C. A loaf of bread to eat. A desk, ink, and a notebook for extra homework. 3. How did Newton solve tricky scientific problems? A. The answers came in a flash of inspiration when Newton was on the toilet. B. By talking things over with scientific friends. C. Worrying away at the problem day and night until he figured out the answer. Newton became professor of mathematics at Cambridge, but no one attended his bum-numbingly boring lectures. So what did he do? A. He rounded up students and forced them to listen. B. Carried on talking to an empty room. C. Tried to make his lectures interesting with a few jokes and amusing stories. And that brings me to the end of the lecture. Any questions? Good night, sweep up now, sir. 4. Carried on talking to an empty room. 5. Newton's dog, Diamond, knocked over a candle and years of hard work went up in flames. What did he do? A. Drew his sword and killed the dog. B. Rewrote his work from memory. C. He told the dog off and went on to study something new and experimental. Rewrote his work from memory. What your teacher's score means. 1 to 2, your teacher's guessing. 3 to 4, your teacher knows a bit but doesn't know everything, much like any other teacher. 5, hard luck. Your teacher's read this book. Newton's moving book. Newton didn't publish his discoveries for 20 years. He was too busy with his mathematical work. But then, at last, fear fathers might grab the glory, Newton wrote a book about his ideas. He shut himself away for 18 months and worked 20 hours a day. Sometimes Newton's assistant reminded him that he'd missed supper. Have I? Newton would murmur sleepily. Then he nibbled at the food and got back to work. The carriage was for your supper, sir. Newton's book was called The Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematicae, and it was the most brilliant science book ever written. In it, he explained the whole universe in a way that made sense. Well, it would have been made sense if the book hadn't been in Latin and filled with mystifying maths. Newton described gravity and three crucial laws about forces and how things move. These laws show how squids squirt water backwards in order to move forwards. They explain what happens when distant stars blow up, and why low-flying sparrow droppings flat on your head. One way to imagine Newton's laws is to think of a really horrible morning. What do you mean? Every day is like that. Newton's first law. What the law says. If left alone, a motionless object doesn't move. A moving object carries on moving in a straight line at a constant speed as long as another force doesn't make a change course. What the law means. You stare wearily at your breakfast. Your cornflakes are motionless, and they're going to stay that way until you summon up the energy to eat them. You clumsily knock your spoon, and half your breakfast goes flying. A cornflake falls on your dad's head. The cornflake would have flown in the same direction forever, but the force of gravity pulled it down. A cornflake would travel in a straight line forever if it wasn't for the force of gravity, and the ceiling. Downward force of the hand catapults the cornflake upwards. Oops, sorry, Dad. Newton's second law. What the law says. When a force is appalled to an object, it changes its momentum. The force makes the object move in the same direction as the force, at a speed proportional to the strength of this force. What the law means. That's why the force of a hefty kick can send a football whizzing towards a goalie at a deadly speed. Newton's third law. What the law says. When an object exerts a force on another object, the second object will push back just as hard. What the law means. You're late, and you're jogging to school, but you're still not properly awake. You slam into a lamppost, and the lamppost wallops you back. It's true. This really does happen. Ouch! Wham! That you never knew. When Newton's apple hit the ground, the earth bumped against the apple. That's what Newton's third law says. Things always push back with equal force. But the earth moved such a tiny distance no one noticed. Oddly enough, a unit of force was later named the Newton in the scientist's honor. And the weight produced by one Newton is roughly the same as an apple. But Newton was no ordinary genius. He had a nasty side, too. Newton's nasty nature. 1. When Newton was 3 years old, his mum remarried. Isaac hated his stepfather and often thought of killing him. He didn't, of course, but he was pleased when the stepfather died. 2. At school, Newton had no friends until he thumped the school bully with great force. Newton was smaller than his opponent, but his courage helped win the fight. After this nasty incident, Newton became popular. 3. Newton disliked women and never married. He hated his friend John Locke's attempts to introduce him to ladies. Later, Newton wrote to Locke, "When a woman told me you were sickly and would not live, I answered to her brother, 'To her better, you are dead.' Thanks a lot." But that didn't stop Newton generously allowing his niece Catherine to do his cooking and cleaning. 4. Newton was a miserable man. He had no hobbies apart from work. He rarely laughed, and he called poetry a kind of ingenious nonsense. 5. In 1686, Newton fell out with scientist Robert Hooke, 1635 to 1703. Hooke unjustly accused Newton of pinching his ideas on gravity. In a letter, Newton called Hooke a pretender and a grasper, and refused to talk to him. 6. After writing the Principia, Newton had a nasty turn. He went mad for 2 years and did no scientific research. Some historians reckon Newton was a bit depressed, but others say he was poisoned by the mercury he used for chemistry experiments. 7. When he got better, Newton was appointed Warden of the Royal Mint and reformed Britain's coinage. It was said that nasty Newton enjoyed catching forgers and arranging especially nasty executions for them. I will now demonstrate another of the fatal forces. 8. German Gottfried Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, claimed he invented calculus. Newton accused Leibniz of pinching his idea, but in fact Leibniz had made the discovery independently at the same time as Newton, and it was Leibniz who had actually coined the word calculus. Newton called it fluxions, which sounds like the effects of a nasty tummy bug. 9. Newton came to a horrible end. He moved to the country to improve his health, but a few weeks later he fell sick and died of a stone in his bladder. By then, however, he was a nasty-tempered old man of 84, but still a great genius. Newton, in his own words, like many geniuses, Newton was hard to understand. Here's what he said about himself. If I've seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. But he's standing on a chair, Mum. Note, Newton didn't mean human pyramids. The giants he referred to were earlier scientists who inspired him. He also said, I seem to have been only a bay played on the seashore, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. Was that a black bull? Note, Newton meant that he learned enough to realize there was more to learn. He was right. He'd only scratched the surface. There are loads of more fatally fascinating facts about horses. You'll find them in the next chapter.
Oh yes, very funny.
Forceful facts. Forces are everywhere. You can't do much without bumping into them, but hopefully not with a fatal crunch. Oddly enough, though, before Newton, people knew very little about how forces worked. Mixed-up motion theories. A scientist will tell you that a force is something that affects the movement or shape of an object or person. Sounds fairly vague, but before Newton, scientific theories were even more mixed up. One of the first people to write about forces was a Greek genius called Aristotle. Hall of Fame, Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC. Nationality, Greek. Aristotle was a doctor's son. His parents died when he was a child, and as a young man, he blew their money on wild parties. Before he was 17 years old, Aristotle had a sudden change of heart and sent himself back to school. Weird, I suddenly feel like doing loads of homework. He went to study under the brainy philosopher called Plato in the Academy at Athens. Aristotle liked it there so much that he stayed for the next 20 years as a pupil and then as a teacher. Aristotle traveled for 4 years and eventually moved to Macedonia, where his old mate Philip happened to be king. Phil asked Aristotle to teach his boy Alexander. Aristotle must have done a good job because young Alexander became Alexander the Great and conquered a great chunk of Asia. By the time Aristotle died of acute indigestion, he had written about everything from politics to how grasshoppers chirp, and he even had a few things to say about forces. Mystery motions. Here's how Aristotle explained forces. Things move as long as they're in contact with whatever is moving them. Oh yeah, so how come arrows don't fall to the ground as soon as you fire them? That's because the air behind the arrow pushes it along. If you push something with the same force, it moves at the same speed. So why does a rock speed up when it falls to Earth? Ouch! It wants to hurry down to Earth. Its natural resting place. Throb. Eh? Wrong, wrong, and wrong again. Thus, for 2,000 years, everyone thought Aristotle's wacko ideas were right. Eventually, Newton used maths to prove Aristotle wrong. So nowadays, we've got forces assessed. As a scientist might say, learning about forces is as easy as riding a bike. Oh yeah? Riding a bike is loads harder, and just to prove it, we've asked scientists to try. Small print. It's not our fault if we end up in hospital, okay? Lesson 1. Wobbly balance. Remember learning to ride a bike? Tough, wasn't it? Inside the scientist's ears are fluid-filled spaces called semicircular canals. Teachers have a larger air-filled space where their brain should be. Haha. These canals help her balance on two wheels. As the liquid sloshes around, sensors tell her brain whether she's still upright. Her brilliant brain also notices the force of gravity, her speed, the slope, and wind direction. Yep, all at the same time. Helmet protects the scientist's precious brain. Superb control and balance. Scientist bum. Center of gravity. Terrified hedgehog. It helps her balance if her science books, sandwiches, etc. aren't draped over one handlebar. Ideally, her bum is the center of gravity, the point around which everything else is sensibly balanced. Lesson 2. Effortless inertia. Inertia means that things at rest tend to stay put. That's why it takes more energy to start cycling than to keep going. But our scientist has got to start somewhere. So she gets pedaling, and once she's moving, it's easier to carry on. Inertia helps her keep going in a straight line, but she still needs a bit more pedaling and puffing. Phew! Oh dear, the hill seems to have got a bit steeper. Hills require more energy. Scientists have to push down harder on the pedals. Puff! Gasp! Lesson 3. Massive momentum. Momentum is a measure of the scientist's ability to keep going, and her momentum depends on her mass. If your reaction to the statement is to say, "You're what?" you'd better read the next bit. Mass means how much there is of the scientist. Everything in her body, her clothes, and even what she had for breakfast. Her mass, her bike's mass, and her speed combine to produce her momentum. Whee! Whee! No need to pedal. Not again, says the hedgehog. Whoosh! Lesson 4. Mixed up momentum. Oops! She knocks the school bully flying. Scientists would say she's transferred momentum to the bully and call this conserving momentum. The posh scientific word for speed in one direction is velocity, so she better pedal at quite a velocity in order to conserve her life. Transfer of momentum takes place here. Bully lands somewhere over here. Or the bully's heading towards her on a skateboard. They're going to crash! As they crash, the two momentums cancel each other, so they both grind to a halt. Result? Trouble! Lesson 5. Galloping gravity. Velocity is greater when cycling downhill. Gravity tries to pull the scientist to the center of the Earth, and the bottom of the slope is a bit nearer the center of the planet than the top. This explains why, if she loses her balance, it's easier to fall off her bike than stay on. By the way, if she did make it right through to the Earth's center, there would be no gravity and she would float around being roasted in the fiery heat. Not nice? Tired yet? Our scientist is. She's run out of kinetic energy. That's the posh scientific name for the energy she uses when moving. Oh well, we'll give her a few minutes to recover and then we'll put her back to work. Can't go on, gasp! Time to refuel, slurp, suck. Okay, let's go. Lesson 6. Awkward acceleration and drag. For the scientist, the word acceleration means change in speed or direction. So even when she slows down, she calls it acceleration. But when she accelerates down a hill, she feels the wind whistling up her nostrils and everywhere else and trying to slow her. This force is called drag. If it's particularly windy, it'll drag her off her bike. The results could be fatal. Wind blows against the scientist and causes drag, which slows her down. Crouching down reduces the drag and helps her to go easier. Lesson 7. Curious cornering. As the scientist rounds the corner, centripetal force pulls her bike into the corner, but her body's momentum tries to make her move in a straight line. Newton's first law, and she feels as if a force is throwing her outwards. In fact, there is no such force. It's all in the scientist's imagination. Scientist leans this way to counterbalance her momentum. Lesson 8. Grinding gears. The gears on the scientist's bike help her cycle uphill. The gears allow her to pedal quicker but with less force. This means she can cycle up the slope without getting puffed out. Yep, gears are great. As a scientist would say, they're a great way of transferring forces. Lesson 9. Furious friction. The force of friction slows moving objects. It happens when a moving object touches another object. The scientist's rubber tires grip the road and provide this force. This helps her control the bike and avoid fatal collisions. Lack of friction makes cycling on ice a slippery experience, and performing wheelies on the local skating rink is definitely out. When she wants to slow down or stop, the rubber brakes grip her wheels and friction stops her bike, hopefully. If she brakes too hard, her momentum throws her forward, and she performs spectacular but possibly fatal handlebar acrobatics. Lesson 10. Vicious vibrations. When a scientist rides her bike along a bumpy path, she may feel a few vibrations. These are shockwaves carrying the force of impact from the tires. Her tires and saddle springs are designed to soak up some vibrations, but that doesn't stop her body vibrating, her muscles twitching, and her eyeballs bouncing slightly in their sockets. Shake, quiver, tremble, rattle, wobble, vibrate,